Welcome to Expanding Your Faith, a podcast hosted by Bishop Greer Godsey, the Old Catholic Churches International. Expanding Your Faith brings together a panel of well-educated clergy and laity to discuss modern events with a biblical perspective. Our podcast is about to start. Please stay tuned. This edition of Expanding Your Faith. I'm Bishop Greer. Joining me tonight is Reverend Mark.
Greetings, everyone.
And Bishop Ben.
Greetings and blessings to all.
So tonight we're going to be talking about the Jewish temple. We have our resident Jewish temple scholar, Reverend Dr. Mark Trim here,
who
will be enlightening us about the Jewish temple and all the different pieces and things and how it connects to Jesus and that kind of stuff. And so I thought this would be a great podcast because, you know, it is something that Reverend Mark is passionate about. He likes to teach about the temple. And so I thought, you know, why not? Let's do it, because I have found over the years that so many Christians have no idea what the Jewish temple is, what the pieces signify, or anything. And so when we read about this in the Bible, people's eyes just kind of gloss over. So this will be a good time to kind of give everybody a little primer on that. So Reverend Mark, I'll let you start where you want to, and we'll just go from there.
Well, thank you, Bishop. I am not a scholar. I wish I was. I wish I had the opportunity to pour into my studies to get to that scholarly level, but maybe one day. The temple or tabernacle is an interesting study topic. It's something that I've was always drawn to study, and there's multiple tabernacles, and we'll talk about this, or temples. I'll be using that word interchangeably. What we'll talk about tonight specifically is the Tabernacle of Moses. So the first Jewish tabernacle, temple, the first organized place that we find that God institutes to say, this is where we worship, this is a place where we hold things, and so forth. So you know, we'll be talking about Moses' tabernacle, which is a, it was a non-permanent structure. So this particular tabernacle in the Old Testament, we find it described in the book, specifically in Exodus, but there's a little bit of it in Deuteronomy, a lot in Exodus and Leviticus. So, and people may ask why we even look at this. I believe that it helps us see the depth of who God is, see the interesting facets of Jewish culture and how it pointed to Jesus. And just in the time of Moses, why God would institute a particular place or a tabernacle. But I believe the reason for that is, as humans and as worshipers of God, we need focus. We need things that point us towards and remind us of God's divine love, reminds us of God's presence, reminds us of God's grace, and reminds us that God is among us. And, you know, why should we look at some of these ancient texts or practices? We're told that this that the tabernacle helps us understand examples and to ponder things and to understand some of the ministry of Jesus and right. pointing towards the ministry of Jesus. I believe we can catch glimpses of ourselves wrapped up in this, patterns of things that might help us to understand struggles or disciplines that we can embrace that will help us be more like the divine, to be more like Christ. I believe in the study of the tabernacle and its complexities, its evolution, its symbolism, and pointing towards Jesus, and enabling us to really kind of understand our spiritual walk. I am not one that subscribes to building the furniture that was inside the tabernacle. I'm not one that subscribes to building a little replica of it and putting it in the front yard or putting it in the basement of the church or in the sanctuary itself. There's a lot of churches that do that. There's one particular church I know that they have replicas of all of the furniture that we'll talk about tonight set and laid out in their sanctuary. So, at any point, if you have something that you want to interject, Bishop, bishops, just stop me and say, "Hey, I want to interject." It is an amazing study, and it's a wonderful study to dive into. I believe that we can look at the specifics of this place of worship and glean fresh perspectives of God's love for us.
Right.
So the tabernacle we're speaking of today, again, is the tabernacle of Moses. This is said in the book of Exodus. This is the time in which Israel has left Egypt. They've they're journeying through the wilderness. And the tabernacle is the first of a few. The tabernacle, what we call the tabernacle of Moses, because Moses is the one who had received instructions for its construction. And again, right. this is a tabernacle that is non-permanent. We would call it a tent. Some people may look at it and call it a tent. But you have the tabernacle of David. You have the Temple of Solomon, Temple of Herod, the temple in Jesus' time, a few other references, a few other times. This particular tabernacle was referred to as the tent of meeting, or the tabernacle of the congregation. So tent of meeting is a place of meeting and the tabernacle of the congregation. So the tent of meeting alludes to the fact in the teaching and the belief that God came down, dwelt, in one of the particular rooms of the tabernacle, and that God would give instruction in that particular room. We'll talk about that later. And the tabernacle of congregation, it again alludes to the fact that this tabernacle is for the people as much as it is for God to come and meet. It is for them to focus their attention and to remind themselves that God is in their midst. So during this time, the children of Israel were nomadic. They were travelers to the desert. They were receiving instructions. They were receiving what's known as the moral law, the civil law, and the ceremonial laws. So at this time, they're being taught or being instructed through Moses of the moral, civil, and ceremonial laws. Moral laws we classify up under the Ten Commandments, you know, murder, don't murder, that is,
right.
Children honoring, fleeing covetousness, theft, that type of stuff, civil law, or it could be called Book of the Law, would be the punishment or the making of restitution for violation of God's laws, the ceremonial laws. were the religious life relating to the priesthood, laws relating to the tabernacle, the sacrifices, the ceremonial, or the cleanliness laws, dietary laws, festival laws, tithing laws. So they're receiving all of these instructions at the time that Moses receives the instructions on to build the tent, to build the tabernacle. So Israel had left captivity. They're forming a nation. So there was a lot of instructions. There was a lot of order being developed. There was a lot of stuff taking place at this time. So they were developing as a nation. Exodus 25 is one of the beginnings and mentionings of the tabernacle. It says, they shall make me a sanctuary so I can dwell with them in accordance with all that I show you concerning the pattern of the tabernacle and all its furniture, and you shall make it. So you've got two words there. You've got a sanctuary, and then you have a tabernacle. Both are used to convey the idea of dwelling. In Hebrew, sanctuary is mikdash, and God, if we have Hebraic scholars, please forgive me for my enunciation. It means consecrated, a consecrated place. It's a hallowed place. It's holy, and it's specifically dedicated. So that's what sanctuary means. Tabernacle, mishkan, is the Jewish word mishkan, and it is a residence. It's a habitation. And I like how it is linked to one of the root words, shepherd's hut, with an understanding that this is a place for animals and graves. So that'll come into play in a minute. So you've got a consecrated place, sanctuary. It's hallowed. It's holy. It's where we get our term. Sanctuary today, when we go into the main auditorium of a church, usually where the word is spoken, or the minister preaches, or in my case, babbles, rambles. tabernacle. So Moses instructed to build a sanctuary, and then instructed to build a tabernacle. So one and the same. So a consecrated place, a place of residence, habitation, and it alludes to in the definition that it's a place like a shepherd. They'll receive leading, they'll receive instruction in that dwelling place. So the tabernacle is holy, and it is a place in which... along with animals, there is a separation from one state of being to another that will establish. There's a state of death to life. There's a state of illumination from darkness to light. And a reminder of being God's own child. So the tabernacle of Moses is to be portable. It's a tent, because remember, Israel is wandering. They're going places. They're here and there. It contains various curtains. It has coverings over wooden structure. It contains furniture and items that are to be constructed. They didn't have they don't have any of this stuff as far as the structure. They've got to build it and make out all of it. It will have three apartments or compartments. It'll have three areas. It'll have the holiest of holies. It'll have the holy place, and you'll have the outer court. Some people refer to it as the outer court, inner court, holy of holies. Most people refer to it as outer court, holy place, most holy place. So each of those three are divided. Each of those three places are divided. The outer court would be surrounded by beams and a wooded, like, fence type area. they could be taken up and taken down. Each of these places would have special pieces of furniture. So in the outer court, there's a couple of pieces of furniture, the Holy of Holies, or the Holy Place. Let me back up. So each of these will have different types of furniture. The Holy Place, or the Holy of Holies, will have the Ark of the Covenant. If you've ever seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, that's a loose reference you can think of. The Holy Place will have the most furniture. They'll have the golden altar of incense, the table of shewbread or showbread, depending on what part of the country you're from, and you'll have the golden candlestick, or some people call it the menorah. And then the outer court will have the brazen altar and the brazen laver. So, again, mobile structure, furnitures could be built and placed within that structure. So, so when you lay all this out, you lay out the furniture, you lay out where everything goes. If you lay out the tabernacle and position it as it is instructed, the 12 tribes were to occupy in the encampment. The tabernacle would be right in the middle of the 12 tribes of Israel.
Right.
Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Dan, Naphtali, Gan, Asher, Ephraim, Benjamin, Manasseh. Those are all tribes. Levi being the priesthood, it's not really considered as part of the 12 tribes. That's right. A whole other teaching. But if you lay all those tribes out where they were supposed to be in encampment, it depicts a cross. Okay, with the tabernacle being in dead center of it. And then when you lay out the furniture in the tabernacle, the way it's supposed to lay, it formulates a cross as well. So it's an interesting little, just a little side note. And again, stop me if you have something interesting to interject, because...
Well, I have up on the screen...
Yeah, go ahead.
...the image of the entire complex, the original... tabernacle of Moses up on the screen for those that want to see it. And it's interesting because this image has a comparison of an American football field next to the tabernacle, and the tabernacle makes up about maybe close to half of an American football field. It's relatively small by comparison.
Right. Yeah. So in Exodus 25, 1 through 8, it talks about the offerings that the Israelites, again, they've just left, but they have left Egypt, and they're out doing and building and growing. Still mobile. And God says to Moses, take for me an offering from all whose hearts prompt them to give. I think that's interesting. You will receive an offering to me. So God says, ask the nation to give an offering to me. So this is the offering that you shall receive: gold, silver, bronze, blue, purple, crimson yarns, fine linen, goat's hair, tanned ram skins, fine leather, acacia wood, oil for lamps, spices for the anointing oil, and for the fragrant incense, onyx stones and gems to be set in the ephod, and a breastplate. And they shall make me a sanctuary so that I can dwell with them. Josephus, who is a first century Jewish historian, wrote of the tabernacle of Moses, referring to the individuals, the people, It says the Israelites rejoiced at what they had seen and heard of their conductor, Moses, and were not wanting in diligence according to their ability. Now when these things were brought together with great diligence, for everyone was ambitious to work the work even beyond their ability. So Josephus is stating that the people were excited to bring all these things to make something for God based on instructions. You know, probably wondering what it was, but most of these people had built things in Egypt, and so, you know, construction was not beyond their ability.
Right.
So in Exodus 31:35, there's two different people assigned to oversee construction, as Moses dictated to them, Bezalel and Aholab. Those individuals were overseeing the construction. So in the materials used in the structure, in the construction of the tabernacle, and most of this bleeds over into the temples, the eventual temples set in Jerusalem. You have gold, which is referring to divinity or divine nature. Find that in 1 Peter 1. Silver refers to redemption, atonement, ransom money. We know that Jesus was betrayed for silver. Brass is used for strength, and it sometimes refers to judgment against wrong. That's found in Deuteronomy 28. Onyx stones and gems. These were worn on the priest's garments, on the breastplate specifically. These speak of the gifts of God. I'll come back to that in a little bit because it's really cool. Or the blessings of the Spirit.
Right.
Because the stones represent each tribe and the diversity in each tribe. Fine linen, goat's hair, is a reference to righteousness. Revelation 19. Acacia wood or shittim wood, depending on your translation, is a durable wood. It's very, very durable. It is translated in the Septuagint, which is the translation of the Old Testament into Greek, as incorruptible. Okay, so it's translated as incorruptible. So the shittim tree, often found in the Sinai Desert, is known for its hard, durable, insect-resistant wood. Blue is often representing of heaven because it represents the skies. Purple is very rare in ancient times, and thus it is often devoted to royalty. So it is going to be given. The purple is going to be devoted to the, speaking of the royalty of heaven. Crimson or scarlet represents life, because life is in the blood. It represents blood. It represents sacrifice. Tanned ram skins is a reminder of the ram offered by Abraham, symbolizing dedication and substitution out of Genesis 22. Fine leather. I like leather. I like to sit on it in my car. this is used on the outside. It helps protect the tabernacle on the outside portion. It speaks to humanity. This isn't necessarily precious fur or leather. It's comeliness, protecting the inside. All that's precious and great. So it's just a good resistance, but it represents humanity. Oil for the lamps. This is would be for the golden candlesticks or the menorah. It's the lamp that is inside of the holy place, not the holiest of holies, but the holy place or the inner court. So this is the middle section. Spices for the anointing oil. There's an altar of incense. Again, that's going to be in the middle section. The holy place. The incense had to constantly be burning and constantly be going up, representing the work of the Spirit. And so you had to walk through the incense going up in order to enter into where the Ark of the Covenant was. And that was the most holy place. Fragrant incense, that which we offer from our heart, it represents prayer, represents worship, constantly going up. So, again, the furniture is the Ark of the Covenant, or testimony, Ark of the Covenant testimony. You have the menorah, which is called the golden candlestick. You have the altar of incense, the table of showbread. Then you have the copper basin, or the brazen laver, or you have the copper altar or brazen altar. So, so the Ark of the Covenant is in the holiest of holies. Is all this making sense, or I'm just rambling? There's a point to all of it, I promise. So you have the holiest of holies is the Ark of the Covenant. Then you have the holy place, golden altar of incense, table of showbread, and golden candlestick. So the outer court, place where people could see, even though there's like this surrounding gate or fence of wood, the brazen altar is 5 cubits by 5 by 3, or 7.5 in length. So 7 by 5 by 3. So this first place is it's the first piece of a worshiper could come and encounter as he came through the door of the altar. So you have a fence surrounding the tabernacle. And so on the outside there, there's a cloth. There's some people refer to it as a door, but it was just a cloth that was woven specifically. And it would enter there. In Jesus' day, it would be probably would be considered the sheep gate. So it'd be where they would bring the sheep, but they didn't have a specific place, they just had one entrance. And so they would, if you walked in, the first thing you would see is the brazen altar and then the brazen laver. So the brazen altar is where the sacrifices would go. There's a fire in there. It's where they would take their sacrifices and then burn them and offer them before God. It's made of wood and covered with brass on the outside. So they make the wood, they make the altar, and then they cover it in and out with brass, copper. It was a perfect square with horns on each of the four corners. It was where the blood sacrifices of clean lambs and goats would be offered in the heat of fire unto God for atonement or the covering or the forgiveness of sins. That's in Exodus 27, Leviticus 17. Since the brazen altar was first, it reminds us of humanity, reminds us of our need for the divine's touch upon our life, and it reminds us that we need to sacrifice in order to see goodness and mercy in life. Sometimes we have to sacrifice our own desires. Sometimes we have to sacrifice our angers or our frustrations, and sacrifice is part of life, and it's okay to do that.
Right.
The equal four sides of the altar reminds us is a point towards the Gospels, and it reminds us when we're looking at Christ through the Gospel that Jesus is non-discriminatory. Jesus opens and is all sides, all people, equal coming unto God. The brazen laver is the second piece of furniture was for a wash basin for the priests called the laver or lavatory. Again, a place for washing. So this is in the outer court. This is outside. There's no coverings over this area. Okay. There's a fence around it, but there's no covering over it. So obviously you don't want to burn things and have something covering it.
Right.
So the laver, again, is to wash. It had to have fresh rainwater, had to have fresh water in it. So you would make the sacrifice, and then you would go to this laver, and you would wash. The priest would, not just anybody, but the priest. So it was, again, made of copper, and the priest had to daily wash their hands and feet from dirt and contamination before they could enter into the holy place. So before they entered into the first room that was covered in structure. So you have the outside, fenced in, brazen laver, brazen altar, and then you had a sheet or a covering or a veil on the first entrance, and you would walk in there, and that would be the secondary furniture. And that would be a place in which you would go to, but before you could go in there, you had to wash and you had to clean. You had to wash your hands, your feet, particularly if they were offering sacrifices that day. They had to wash the blood and any dirt. Jesus teaches us that it's important to receive living water by the Spirit, to remind us to to have fresh water, and to wash away those things in our lives, to allow the water of the Spirit, because the Holy Spirit is often referred to as water, especially living water, and to renew our minds, and to allow fresh each and every time or day to come in and minister to our hearts.
Right.
Did you have anything you want to interject?
Not really.
Okay.
I do think it's interesting, the layout here. On this image, it has kind of almost like seats or tables that also surround the exterior of that outer court. I'm assuming that's where they would slaughter the animals in preparation for sacrifice.
Yes.
So people don't think we're just like slaughtering them on the ground and then.
Right. No. especially on Yom Kippur, which is what's called, it's one of the major feast days of Israel. That was a specific day once a year. It's called the Day of Atonement. And it's the day of bringing your sacrifices and, you know, offering the blood of a bull and a goat up in order to wash the sins of the nation.
Right.
So, moving on to the holy place. Keep me on my time here, because this can go forever. The holy place contained gold. And not copper. So as you move forward past sacrifice, past the brazenness of copper, you would move into the gold, which represents the divine touch. They believed it was the divine deity. So things would be made of wood and overlaid with gold. Then you had the golden lampstand, or the menorah, and the golden, and then you had the table of showbread, or the golden table of bread. You had the altar of incense, or the golden altar of incense. Here, the wash priest would enter to perform service and representative worship unto the Lord. So the priest would go there and worship God for the nation. This section tells that God is not simply interested in our forgiveness, but also communion and worship with us. So it's not just about sacrifice, it's about fellowship and relationship. Excuse me. So the golden lampstand on the south side of the holy place stood the pure golden lampstand. And this lampstand illuminated the room. The gold was formed into the shape of an almond tree in full bloom. It had six fruitful branches with a central shaft, so seven branch candlestick, but a central shaft, which would be the trunk. They were designed to hold seven bowls filled with olive oil to provide light. So when you went into this place from the outside, this holy place, this is the first entrance of the, it looks like a tent, okay? So you had the outer court surrounded by a fence, and then you had the tabernacle on the inside, and this was just a square, and it was covered with leather, it was covered with woven cloth, and then you would go in, it was all covered, then you would go in, and this would be the first quote-unquote room. And in there, this is where you'd find the secondary furniture, the lampstand. So there was no light at all in the holy place except that which came from the golden lampstand. So it reminds us the need for God to illuminate our path, show us the direction that we needed to go, show us where we need to go. The table of showbread was 3 feet by 1 feet, 1.5 feet by 2 feet, 3 inches. The table of showbread again is gold, is made of wood and then inlaid with gold, and it does just what it sounds like. It holds bread, okay, fresh bread, fresh manna. And this was on the north side of the inward room. You could only see the bread by the one light. You could only see it by where the bread was and by the golden lampstand. So there was 12 loaves of bread that were set on it, and it was fresh, you know. During the week, the bread was to be displayed before God. On the Sabbath, the priest would eat it. Thus, God and man shared the same table together in fellowship of the bread. So, gives way to the understanding of why we receive bread in our services. And it reminds us it's a type and a shadow of the Lord's table that we read about. As Christ was being led towards crucifixion during Holy Week. Then you have the golden altar of incense. It was 1 cubit by 1 cubit by 2 cubits, or 1.5 feet, 6 inches by 1.5 feet, 6 inches by 3 inches. So the golden altar of incense. I don't think I said what I was describing there.
Cube.
Yep. So the third and last piece was that furniture in the holy place. It stood by the veil. So you had basically a curtain to enter into this room, and then you had a veil that separated this room from where the Ark of the Covenant sat, which is the holiest of holies. So the outward veil, or the first veil, first curtain you came to, was fairly thin. But this inward veil that separated this room from the main, from the holiest of holies, was as thick as the palm or span of your hand. So that veil was very heavy, very specific. But you had to pass by this altar, which was constantly burning and offering up incense. And the altar was to burn incense only. It was not for sacrifice. It was only to burn incense. The incense was a special God-prescribed formula, which was sent out a rich fragrance of smoke, so the priest would light it every morning and every evening. The incense reminds us of offering up prayers, offering up petitions unto God. When one prays in the name of God, there's power, there's an aroma, That's alluded to throughout Scripture, that our prayers are like sweet offerings into the nostrils of God when it comes from our heart. So you need to pass through that incense so that the smell of life would leave you, and God's specific instructions would rest upon us. The holiest of holies is the last room, the last area. You had the Ark of the Covenant covered with a special lid called the mercy seat. This is where it is taught that God's presence resided, was between the two cherubs. So you had the two winged cherubs that were on the ark or on the mercy seat. And this is where God's presence resides. The veil of the curtain blocked the way so that you could not enter in. When it was time, you only went into this place once a year during the time of atonement. And only the high priest could go into that room. There were other priests from the tribe of Levi, the Aramaic priesthood, but only the high priest was allowed in. And when they would go in and they would offer sacrifice, the blood from the sacrifices, they would then obtain mercy on the mercy seat. Okay, so the mercy seat was between the two angels, cherubs. Jewish tradition teaches that on the Day of Atonement, again, this is Jewish tradition, that the wings of the cherubs would meet, signifying that God accepted the sacrifice. Again, that was their tradition. So the Ark of the Covenant is 3 feet by 9 inches, 2 feet by width, 2 feet by 3 inches height, 2 feet by three. The mercy seat, 3 by 9, 2 by 3 in its width. So the ark was a chest, basically. It's a chest made of wood and then covered with gold inward and outward. Okay. And then the mercy seat would sit upon it. It was a lid, basically, to be crude. And it rested in the holiest of holies. The mercy seat would cover it. It was solid gold beaten into winged cherubs, one at each end, looking down where the presence of God was. So the cherub are involved for the protection of God's holiness. Once a year, the high priest alone would go in there. The mercy seat reminds us that there's always mercy with God. It always reminds us that sacrifice is received and that we can always obtain mercy from the divine. So to make up the actual tent area, you had these beams that would align, and the entire tent, if you will, was 45 feet by 15 feet by 15 feet. It was a wooden skeletal structure, again made of shittim wood, overlaid with gold, and there was no solid roof, but the roof structure was the fabric with the leather covering over both. And then, of course, you had the curtains for entering the tabernacle, and they would make up the structure. So 45 by 15 by 15 was the length of the actual, what we would call, tent area. And that held, again, the ark, the showbread, incense, and the menorah. So that was all the interior stuff. And then you would have all of the surrounded by again, a fence.
So essentially the tent portion itself was about the size of a good-sized barn, is what we're basically saying.
Yeah, so... it was pretty, again, it was pretty tall, and it's, anchored down because, again, it's mobile, okay? So how would you like to be the one that has to tear that sucker down? So you had two veils, but the main veil, or curtain, is the best way to describe it, separating all the rooms. The high priest would go in, and they were the only ones that could go to the Holy of Holies. And they would have, they would wear a linen turban, plate of pure gold, holding it together, an ephod on the shoulder straps. They would have a breastplate of what they call breastplate of judgment. It had 12 stones representing the 12 tribes of Israel, and I had a list of what most people think these are. We had I downloaded the Jewish name of all of them, which I cannot pronounce. You had ruby, you had pearl, you had diamonds, emeralds. Let's see if I can pull that back up real quick. Onyx, and each of them would represent the nation coming together on one. And as the high priest would go before God, he was wearing that breastplate, bringing all those tribes before God, representing to God all the people. And all of them, again, different colors, different types. These stones that were inlaid in the breastplate. And I think it's a beautiful callback to the diversity that even God was receiving with the nation of Israel at the time. And it shows us that God makes all different, because each of the tribes all had different different functions. You know, like the tribe of Levi, they were specifically for the priesthood. And then you had the other tribes that were specifically for battle and so on and so forth. But you had the high priest would wear robes similar to what we would see in some very nominal churches. You wear robes on Sunday. So kind of give everybody a point of reference. But these were very specific, made of blue and gold. The high priests would have bells attached to the bottom of their robes, because the Jewish tradition teaches that if the high priest entered into where the Ark of the Covenant was to make atonement or sprinkle the blood, and he was not worthy to be there, the presence of God would strike him dead. So they would actually tie a rope to the high priest's leg. So if they didn't hear the bells chiming while he was doing stuff, they would start yanking to pull him out, because they could not enter into the holy place, the holiest of place, because it was forbidden that only one person could do so. And again, the idea of the whole tabernacle is of worship. It's of going to God, God being in the middle of us, and God being in the middle of the nation. And so when the priest would go to offer these things before God, he was the representative. So the priest had the bells at the end on their robes. That's what we should do, is have bells. Right. I don't know. Do you have bells on?
I don't have bells
on your. Can you put bells on your? Oh, come on. That would be hilarious. You jingling all the way down the aisle.
All the way around the tabernacle, all the way around the altar.
But just to wrap up just all of this, because there's so much more, the point of the tabernacle was to dwell in the middle of the nation and to remind people that God was with them and God was in the midst of them. We know from Christ's teaching that God now dwells within our hearts, that God dwells within our spirits, and is always with us. And so the outward portion and showing of the tabernacle shows by this physical representation is the constant reminder of those things. God is with us. And it's the most simplistic. There's a lot of intricacies here. There's so much into the tabernacle, into the temples that follow, that you could just go on for hours. But that's a rough, very rough overview of it. But the main takeaway is God wants to dwell in the midst of us. So much so that the divine went through all this detail to do so.
Right. And an interesting fact is, as we have this image here on the screen of the tent itself, is that when we read in the Gospels, and we just read a few weeks back, the Passion narrative, that when Jesus died, it says that there was darkness over the whole land, and the veil of the temple was ripped in two. This would be that veil into the Holy of Holies that was ripped in two, and kind of gives us that idea that no longer was it that one person was only allowed to enter before God, but that all people were now welcome.
That's right.
To come before God, to make supplication. So that's one of the interesting facts tie back to Christianity and the temple.
It's important to remember that it wasn't just a piece of cloth,
right,
but that veil was extremely thick. We didn't even get into how they wove this material. It was very well and very tightly made with multiple colored fabric. And so that veil tearing on its own was virtually impossible.
Right.
So I think that shows the love of God, reminding us that God wants to dwell with us.
Absolutely. Bishop Ben, any questions or thoughts?
No, it was very interesting because this stuff that we learned, the basic stuff of seminary school, but not in depth like this. This is very interesting to me to learn the interior of the temple. It was very, very insightful.
It is definitely interesting, and you know, there are a lot of connections back. I mean, we as churches still use incense to this day.
Right.
You know, bread is incorporated into our services, every single service.
Yeah. There's so many tie-ins.
You know, there are. There's so many tie-ins. And, you know, we still use candles on the altar, as a sign of the divine, a sign of light that God provides to us. So there's a lot of tie back to what we still do today in worship. Go back to this early temple. Your final thoughts, Reverend Mark?
I just really want to drive home that point of the symbolism of God being in the midst of the nation, and then, of course, later, the word of Christ coming to us and letting us all know that God no longer just wants to dwell in the center of one particular place, but in all of our hearts, in the center of our lives. And, you know, this was early days of the nation forming to worship God, and it was a reminder of how much the divine wanted to be among humanity. So I really, if there's anything you take away from that, from tonight and all this stuff, is to remember that fact and that desire from God.
Sure. Thank you, Reverend Mark. I appreciate that. Well, this is the end of whatever season this is.
Season 11.
Season 11.
Episode 10.
episode 10, and we will be resuming in July. We'll have that information posted on the web for everyone. Make a decision what date we're going to start back in July. It'll be the first or second Saturday of July, for those that are wondering. And we'll keep everyone informed. And we so appreciate Reverend Mark and Bishop Ben for being here consistently.
Thank you for having us.
Series. They've been a wonderful series that we've done of podcast, and I'm looking forward to season 12. We do even more wonderful things. So, yeah.
It's good. Absolutely. Thank you for hosting us.
You're welcome. Yes. You're welcome. It's always a pleasure. So until we see you for season 12, we hope that you will keep shining bright, my friend.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Expanding Your Faith. For more information on Expanding Your Faith, check us out on facebook.com/expandingyourfaith. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you find your podcasts. Until next week, when we once again attempt to expand your faith, keep shining bright.